Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at theopenhouse.net.au blog site and fm1032.com.au.
The Prime Minister once said, "There is no finer human being in political life than John Anderson." That's not a bad report card, is it? He's often been described as the Mr. Clean of Australian politics. Again, you don't often get that from both sides of the political spectrum. Well, Mr. John Anderson has had that, and he joins us now on Open House. And John, thank you for your time.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's been a couple of years now since you handed your leadership and ministerial responsibilities over because of health grounds and then also to spend a bit more time with family. A couple of years on, is life any slower for you?
Well, the answer is yes, it is. I suspect that very few people have any real insight into how busy a federal political leader's life actually is. The hours are extraordinary. The pressure is extraordinary. I'm still busy, but nothing like I was in those days.
Give us a picture of what your average day used to be like.
Depended very much on whether I was in Canberra or out somewhere in the electorate. I saw the whole of Australia as my electorate, I suppose, as Deputy Prime Minister. But in Canberra, typically, I'd be in the office by about 7:30 in the morning, having already tried to catch up on some of the news of the day. I'd have any early staff meetings I had to. Sometimes it was actually breakfast, so you'd be in even earlier. The dreadful American habit of no time in the rest of the day, so you have breakfast meetings. Then the meetings would start at around 8 with my chiefs of staff and senior advisors. Then we'd have our leadership meeting at 8:30, where the leadership of the coalition, the Prime Minister, the Deputy Prime Minister, the Treasurer and so forth would meet. During the morning, you might have anything from legislation to introduce through to delegations to see, always delegations, always people who, with genuine reasons, who needed to see you. Mm-hmm. And you were never able, never, to beat the demand for people who had some particular cause that they wanted to see you about. Nearly always, there would be some function at lunch. If there wasn't, it would be you wouldn't stop for lunch. You'd try and catch up with your paperwork. You'd never beat the paperwork either. Always media. Then, of course, about 1 o'clock every day, you'd have to prepare for question time. 2 o'clock till 3 would be question time. I usually took further delegations between 3 and dinner at 6:30. Probably one night out of two, there'd be some official function at night. And then again, after dinner, we would turn our minds to departmental business, whatever the portfolio issues of the time were. The problem, of course, at that level of politics is that you never know when the next landmine's going to go off. Mm. Some urgent matter that was totally unforeseeable appears out of the blue, and it might have been something as minor as, in the scheme of things, I suppose, a failure in a power supply at a major airport. Well, that's not minor. Mm. Potentially major ramifications, I suppose, but something like that you have to suddenly turn your mind to. Right through to, of course, the ultimate one, which was the totally unexpected September the 11th. Mm. So it's a great privilege and a great honour to serve in that role, but I suspect much more demanding and far tougher on the people who fill those roles, many of whom, of course, in the end, either don't get there despite their aspirations or if they do, burn out.
Yeah, and you can see why, absolutely. And you can see why you took time not just for health reasons but also to spend more time with the family too. I'm sure that they hardly saw you over those years.
We worked very hard at it. Sundays was always our day. The big issue for me actually was not, you can carve out time, and people should carve out time, and the old saying that on your deathbed you're not going to wish you spent more time at the office.
That's right.
Is absolutely right. I've no doubt about that. The big issue was to make certain that when you were with your family, you weren't giving them second-hand time because you were exhausted or your mind was elsewhere.
And how did you do that? Because I would be exhausted on a Sunday. I'd be collapsing and I'd be trying to recover. How could you actually have time on the weekends for your family? Did you have an exercise regime? It doesn't sound like there's much time left to fit it in.
Tried to. To some extent, you often just felt so exhausted that it was a real effort to push yourself. But I mean, I was very conscious that I didn't have many years with my children and tried to give them what time I could. And, of course, very important in a marriage to keep it fresh as well.
Yes.
So it's a very demanding role. And in the end, for me, for several years, I had a bit of a health issue, which was totally benign, totally non-threatening, not cancerous, not life-threatening. But the medical advice was that it was my lifestyle and the stress levels and the travel that was doing it, because it manifested itself in interrupted sleep. In the end, it beat me. Mm. I'm fortunate in a way that it was something that could be managed, and now, whilst I wouldn't say has left me completely, doesn't really interrupt my life much now.
Okay, that's good to hear. Do you miss the rush of politics and that kind of day that you just described? Do you ever miss it?
No. The answer is no. There are times when I wish I was still more central to some of the debates that do interest me, like water.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, too, these welfare reforms, people have focused quite heavily on what the government's doing in the Northern Territory without perhaps realising that it comes with some further welfare reforms which are really needed in electorates like mine, whereby if families are not ensuring that their children are properly clothed and fed and so forth, if they're on welfare payments, real action can be taken. The welfare payments won't be denied them, they won't lose any money, but it will be possible for it if, in the view of the agencies dealing with families, particularly with children, that it's necessary, they'll find from July of next year that if their priority expenditure is not to ensure the kids are clothed, housed, fed, on school on time, that money will be paid into what amounts to a trust account for them, and they'll be able to withdraw against things like vouchers for the things that they should be spending their money on, and the discretionary expenditure will only be made available to them, money for discretionary expenditure, when they've met their priorities. That is a very important reform. But it's not just Northern Territory children who are suffering because their parents are abusive or neglectful or have very bad priorities and are not getting the children to school fed, clothed and on time.
Absolutely. Much, much bigger problem than simply one particular area. John, was there any one thing that you didn't get to do before you relinquished the Deputy PM role that you would have liked to have done?
Many. And that's life. But you have to accept that somebody else can take them on. Look, I regret that, although I was the architect of what's known as the National Water Initiative, and that is the blueprint for managing Australia's water, and that's now set in stone, that the subsequent mechanisms that we've seen so much fighting over, you know, control of the Murray-Darling Basin and the money and so forth, that I wasn't able to take that further. I think at the time I genuinely took the view, look, I've brought it this far, there are others who can now complete it and probably do it better than me. The welfare reforms, which I just outlined, I felt for so long that they were so needed but couldn't find a way to get them up.
Right.
Now they've been done. I think that's fantastic. So there's just two areas.
Yes.
But, you know, when you've got the hand of the plough, I was there for a long time. I was able to do a lot of things and I was able to participate in a lot of important debates. I was on the committee, for example, that did the first four budgets when we got into government in 1996. It was very grinding work. It was only a small number of us. The Treasurer, the then Finance Minister, a few others, that put the nation's budgets back into order and saving nearly $9 billion a year now in interest. Taxpayers' money was going just to service the debt every year, just the interest. Well, that's money now that can go into other things, whether it's tax cuts, whether it's more overseas aid. That's an area where I think, frankly, we should be more engaged in this country. I wish I'd done more in that area.
Well, this is Open House. We are talking to the former Deputy Prime Minister, John Anderson. We'll podcast this via theopenhouse.net.au. John, while you have walked the corridors of power in Canberra, you're also a man very much acquainted with grief. You lost your mother at an early age. You lost your sister to a freak backyard accident. You even lost your son at the age of 6 months. How have those experiences made you the man you are today?
I don't know that I can entirely answer that. I'm actually a fairly private person, and I think had I known that those things were going to become known in the public arena, and that to some extent people would always come back to them. I read once in the media, a journalist I respect in Canberra said, John Anderson always seems to return to these subjects. That is not right. The media always returned to them. Once it became known, after I'd been in public life for probably a decade, that my sister had died in a tragic family accident, the media never left it alone. And indeed, when people sort of look at my life and write about it or whatever, they tend to define me, or to some extent paint those things as major influences in my life. Look, I suppose they have been. I don't know that I'm the best judge of how influential they have been. I don't know that that's something I'm terribly good at, or whether it's not better simply to leave it to others. There's no doubt that my sister's death when we were teenagers, which was a truly tragic thing, left me a young man, certainly grown up beyond my years, lacking in confidence, and looking for some answers to life. There's no that much I can say.
Yes. You write about it in your biography, Faith and Duty, where you do talk about the fact that it was during a cricket accident, just a simple return of a cricket bowl, basically, that just hit your sister in just the wrong place.
Yeah.
And that actually spurred you on to search for faith, is that right?
Look, I think looking back on it, just to correct something you said there, I didn't write about it. It was written up by my biographer.
Yes. I take it, though, at your okay.
Well, he asked questions. I answered them as honestly as I could. Look, I think it was certainly a catalyst for me. I think the result of that was a fairly chronic loss of confidence in me as a teenager. I felt that anything I hit out firmly might result in a disaster, you see.
Mm.
It certainly caused me to question very deeply, very deeply.
Yeah. How did you regain your confidence?
I don't know that I ever have.
Is that right?
I think to some extent, it's a hard question and a very personal one in a way. I think what happened after I became a believer is that I learnt to put self aside a little bit and learnt how to some extent, I don't want to overpaint this, learnt how to say, I will simply give things my best shot and not get too worried about whether they work out or not. Yes. I'll trust God for that,
yes,
for those things, for the outcomes. And that's what I've tried to do.
Yeah. What was the clincher for you with the faith thing? What was the final turning point for you when it came to Christian belief?
University. At school, I'd sort of become convinced, I guess, at the level of the emotions that God was real. But it was at university when I was studying European history, which is really the story of our own culture, I suppose, over the last couple of hundred years. And the more I looked at it, the more I recognized, firstly, the truth of the biblical assertion that we actually don't want to know God. We'd rather do it our own way. And that the more we had done that, the story of the last couple of hundred years of our culture is us, as a culture, finding every excuse, every reason, every rationale we can for rejecting the traditional Christian view of man and his world. And the more I looked at it, the more I thought every attempt to do this has been an unmitigated disaster. And the ultimate disaster was fascism, which was really about the rejection of any higher authority. It was saying there's no God, we're not accountable to anybody else, the only morality is a struggle for power. And I thought, if this is where you logically end up when you've tried all the other isms, humanism, socialism, communism, whatever-ism, you've rejected the traditional Christian view, you've tried all of those, and you end up in that place. I thought, I can't go there.
Mm.
And for me, it just affirmed at a very deep level that the truth must lie back where so many of our forefathers believed that it was.
Yes.
And when I look at the we've got the spat of atheistic books at the moment.
Yes.
I think in some ways I quite welcome it. It's good to have a debate about these things. And I note these books are selling well. Some of your listeners might have read them.
Well, we've talked about it a lot on Open House.
Have you? Well, let me just throw out a couple of questions. Let me throw out a couple of questions. The first one would be, this idea that Hitchens' book, God is Not Great, really? Well, let's have a look at the people. We gave his secularism and atheism a great run in the 20th century, didn't we? And we had Pol Pot, and we had the Killing Fields, and we had the gulags. Atheistic communism ruined Russia, absolutely ruined it.
Yeah.
You had atheism in the form of fascism. Really? So the alternative is great, is it? No God is great? And then have a look at the other side of the equation and look at the influence of people who took their faith seriously. We've got the film Amazing Grace around at the moment.
Mm.
200 years ago, it was still legal for people in our culture to own other human beings as slaves and to trade in them. And it didn't matter if they died. And it didn't matter if you abused them to the point where they collapsed in agony and gave up their spirits. I mean, the treatment was brutal. They were seen as subhuman. Who turned all of that around? The great Christian reformers did.
Absolutely.
So let's get real about history. I have a love of history. Let's get real about it. What it shows at every point, properly understood, I believe, is that the biblical account of man and his condition and the world we live in is the only credible one.
Mm.
And that's the point when I realized that I couldn't accept the alternatives. My only claim to spiritual fame, I think, is that C.S. Lewis wrote in 1928 that he was the most reluctant convert there in Oxford in all Christendom. Well, that was only until 1978.
When you came along.
But I think I was even more dejected because I thought, this is going to be no good. I'll lose all my chances of success and friends and all of those sorts of things. But I believe it's the truth and I can't walk away from it. And yes. I've sensed, you know, I'm more convinced than ever. I'm absolutely certain of the truth.
Yes. John, has your faith in any way been detrimental to you? Have you lost anything as a result of being a believer in the political realm?
I don't believe so. Don't say that everybody likes it or approves of it, or that I'm not. Well, I have been. I'm certainly scorned by a couple of the radio shock jocks and so forth, or have been over the times. But generally speaking, no. Look, I think part of the reason for that. Can I say this? My guess is that despite, you know, the too clever by half and very arrogant writings that we were just referring to around the place, this is not going to be an age of irreligion. I think even in Western culture, people are beginning to say, well, don't know whether I can re-embrace it, but I'm sure not too sure about where we're going at the moment. That's just in Western culture. The truth is, globally, of course, this will not be a century of irreligion. This will be a century of great debate and ferment about what we believe and what stacks up and what doesn't. And there will, of course, there already is, there'll be real tensions between opposing views.
Yeah.
And, of course, the other thing we lose sight of in Australia, we think, you know, when we're being smug about this thing, we think, oh, you know, this happy materialism that we all blunder along in, we don't need God anymore, that's irrelevant, and what have you. Globally, this is not a secular age. You've got an explosion of beliefs, and that includes Christianity. Look at China, look at Korea, look at the African continent, look at other parts of Asia, look at South America.
Yeah, absolutely. You see faith and searches for faith all around us. There's a whole marketplace there of spiritual ideas that people are exploring more and more and more. And yes, the growth of the Christian faith is also right in there as well. If you review those years since 1978 when you did become a Christian, John, has your faith changed at all from those early years?
Probably not in terms of my core beliefs, but in terms of the maturing that I hope has taken place, I think it has broadened me to an awareness that there are people of real faith in all denominations and people of no faith who appear to be outwardly very faithful in all denominations. Mm. And so some of the most, I mean, I suppose if I wear a label, I hate labels, but if I wear a label, I suppose I'd be seen as a Sydney evangelical. Mm-hmm. And yet some of the most marvellous Christian friends that I have are from the Catholic tradition. Mm-hmm. And some of the people who are most difficult and pompous and I think farthest removed from the true humility that's a mark of Christ are some of my fellow travellers in my own denomination.
Right.
And, you know, one of the privileges of this position is you get to meet people from all around the world and meeting Christians from the Middle East, for example. There would have been a time when some of them, I think the outward manifestations of their faith would have made me choke on my Weet-Bix and I mightn't have got over that. But I've matured to the point where I can see now the real depth of conviction and faith in some of them. Yeah. And I'm very thankful for that.
Yes.
So I think what I've learned is not to stand on my own pride quite so much.
It's a good lesson. I think we can all learn that. John, wrapping up, what does the future hold for John Anderson? What are the dreams and what are the plans for the future? You're still the member for GWIDA.
But only till the next election.
That's for sure? You're going to step
absolutely.
Down?
Yeah, I'm absolutely, I'm all, in political terms, as Newton said towards the end of his life, I'm packaged, sealed and waiting for the post. He said that just before he died. I'm not intending to die physically yet, but it is time for me to move on. Look, my wife and I want to spend more time together. We have a very very wonderful marriage, and we have four children who are growing up. We want to spend more time with them. We have our own farming business, which we both love, and I will probably take, as in the jargon, a couple of interesting for-profits and a couple of interesting not-for-profits.
Okay.
In terms of the very, and I'm, you know, a bit humbled by it, but I've been asked to do an amazing range of things, and I've tried to choose carefully, or am in the process of finalising very carefully, the things where I think, A, I can make a difference, and B, which I will find interesting. And I'm thankful for those opportunities, but If I were to summarize it from a Christian point of view, I think, I mean, there's no such thing as a theology of retirement that I've ever been able to see. I think we need to be active in the pursuit of God's work.
Absolutely.
To the best of our ability for as long as we can. So hopefully I can find other areas to make a contribution. This is a wonderful country. And I rejoice in our prosperity. I think it's a marvellous thing. Notwithstanding, I know that there are some people who are still missing out. But can I say that is not the heart and soul of the nation. Our values, which stem from our beliefs, are what really matter, and we need to pay some serious attention to our beliefs.
Well said. John Anderson, it's been wonderful to talk to you. Thanks so much for your time, and certainly pray for your future, and have no doubt there's going to be some exciting things around the corner.
Thank you, and to you and to your listeners, take care.
That's John Anderson, former Deputy Prime Minister of the Nation and a federal member for GWIDA.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit theopenhouse.net.au.